Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Got Paul Craig Roberts back. It's great to have Paul back. Paul, I wanted to get your comments on the events in Cyprus, but maybe you can begin by saying something about your new book, The Failure of Laissez-Faire Capitalism, An Economic Disillusion of the West. I think it ties in with all the stuff going on, including Cyprus. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, glad to be with you, Stephen. Thank you.
I think your book is important. You always address issues, vital issues, that really tie into the things that are going on, whether it's in Cyprus or across Europe, in America. I mean, these things all, there's a common thread to all of it. Talk about your book a little bit and tie it into Cyprus.
Will do. The book is written in three parts. The first part shows problems in economic theory, where economists are quite content and think they have explanations. But in fact, the explanations are defective and incorrect. And these incorrect explanations in economic theory lead to incorrect policies based on these theories. And I run through a range of these. One of them, of course, is the confusion of free trade with jobs offshoring. And this confusion permitted just millions and millions of American middle-class jobs to be moved offshore. And, of course, with the jobs go the consumer incomes, the gross domestic product, the tax base, and so on. And, of course, that is our greatest economic problem, even greater than the financial crisis, is that we no longer produce jobs that have upward mobility, that allow people to rise up in the system, and thereby we have destroyed what has always given the United States its social, political, and economic stability. There are other parts of economics that are equally wrong. One is the economist assumption that man-made capital is a perfect substitute for nature's capital. And what this assumption does, it lets them overlook the ecological cost of using up resources of pollution in its various forms, because the assumption is that whatever happens to nature's capital, it can be fully offset by man-made capital. And this, of course, is an absurdity. And there are other such problems. I'll only mention one other because I don't want to spend the whole time on part one. Another problem is the question of external cost or social cost. So many of the real cost of production are not borne by the firms undertaking the activity. Instead, they are imposed on third parties, on the general public, on the environment. For example, one of the costs of chemical fertilizer farming, of agribusiness, is the runoff, which pollutes the rivers and which has led to massive dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. This cost is not included in the price of agricultural products. It doesn't raise the cost of the firm's production. It doesn't reduce their profits. It's just imposed externally. These costs are mounting. We may be reaching a point where the external cost of production are greater than the value of the additional output. So this is another massive failure. So that's three failures. The second part of the book documents the destruction of the United States economy by jobs offshoring. It uses the official data of the government. It shows that the economy can no longer produce high productivity, high wage, high salary jobs, but can only produce lowly paid domestic service jobs, waitresses, bartenders, hospital orderlies, this type of thing. And therefore, the workforce is transitioning from an industrialized high-wage workforce into a third-world workforce of domestic service. So we're doing the opposite of development. We are undeveloping and moving back toward the state, say, of India 30 years ago. I also use the official statistics to show that the Bureau of Labor Statistics does not expect any growth in jobs that require university education. So we have this massive investment in colleges and universities, but there's no prospects for their graduates. The third part of the book deals with the so-called debt crisis. The debt crisis was a direct consequence of deregulation. The deregulation, that is, the laissez-faire, did not result in libertarian nirvana. It resulted in crony capitalism. So when I speak of the failure of laissez-faire economics, I'm speaking of the failure of regulation, of deregulation. You know, it's been going on for about 25 years in the United States, France, England, New Zealand, Australia, and everywhere is having the same consequence, that the market is no longer subject to social control. It's dominated by a handful of greedy, powerful interest groups that use the deregulated market to monopolize, to concentrate, and to practice the worst forms of fraud and financial corruption. The other aspect of part three shows that everywhere banking crises resulting from the deregulation are being dealt with by overturning democracy. For example, this we'll talk more about Cyprus, but it's the most recent example. In Cyprus, you may remember the first deal that was brought, the parliament voted down. The second deal that was brought, part of the deal that the EU, the European Union, and the IMF imposed on Cyprus prohibited any vote. In other words, the decision was taken away from the people, away from their elected representatives, and the president of the country was forced to sign it on his own. So this is a deal that required no democratic decision-making and prohibited it. The same thing happened in Greece. You may remember when the Greece crisis hit, the prime minister said, okay, I'm going to have a referendum on this, I'm going to put it to a vote. And instantly, the EU put the foot down and said, you are not, you're resigning, get out, we're appointing a banker to rule Greece. You may remember, all of that actually happened. The same thing happened in Italy. They overturned the elected government, appointed a banker, and in fact, every member of the appointed banker's cabinet was appointed. There were no elected members in the executive branch of the Italian government. And so we see this overturning of democracy everywhere. And that is really what that's a sort of a brief summary of the book. You cannot get this explanation anywhere.
It's not in the press.
The policymakers don't talk about it. Most people don't know about it. When they hear about it, they say, "What? How could this be? But that's exactly what the situation is.
Well, it really is, and everything you said, I've either commented on or written on, I'm very well aware of it, and I agree with you, Paul. Too few people realize what's going on. It really is shameful. It showed up a little bit in Italy with the elections that happened weeks back. Only 10% of the Italian voters supported Mario Monti and his predatory government, unelected leader of a country. And of course, the same thing happened in Greece. I remember writing about the fact that the Greek Papandreou I guess it was, yeah. who called for a national referendum, and he was summarily scorned and dismissed. I get these Greek names mixed up, Paul, but he was dismissed, and an unelected individual took his place, a name very similar to his. Again, it's hard to remember all these names, but that's the way they did it. And I mean, it really isn't much different when you look at the way party bosses across Europe and America run elections. I mean, people don't have any say over who will be nominees. They simply get the choice from column A or column B, and the party bosses choose these people. And it doesn't matter whether you've got a party that claims itself more left of center or right of center. They basically support the same policies. So, I mean, I didn't know anything about the Cypriot politics. I don't know that much about it now, except that they sold out their own people. And Cyprus matters, even though it's a very tiny country, about 1 million people. And now they're literally, I mean, they didn't really set a precedent, Paul. They set a precedent going after depositors. But Wall Street set a similar precedent of many, many years ago. MF Global, I'm writing another article in Cyprus for tomorrow. I call it, I forget some of my titles, I use so many. The one for tomorrow is called Depositor Haircuts, : The New Normal. Well, I guess you can loot in different ways. You can go after depositors. You can go after investors. You can do it any way you want. But looting is the name of the game. And now everybody is fair game. Terrible situation.
Yeah. Well, first, Stephen, I think the differences are pronounced between Cyprus, Greece, Italy, and party bosses here, because here the format of democracy is not challenged or bypassed. It just may not work very well because of the party bosses, and I'm not even sure the party bosses any longer have any weight. It's mainly the private powerful interest groups like the Israel lobby, Wall Street, the military security complex. They have essentially taken over the government. But to this point in the United States, we haven't said that, decisions can be made without the people's representatives. Except in the case of war, because both Bush and Obama have taken powers away from the Congress. But they haven't said it as a matter of economic policy. Now, what has happened in Cyprus is another untoward development. They have redefined bank depositors as lender investors. So when you put your money in the bank as a depositor, you are no longer a depositor with access to your money. You have lent the money to the bank, or you have made an investment in the bank. And therefore, if the bank gets in trouble, your money is your risk capital. You are like a shareholder in the bank or a bondholder of the bank. And so the bank can access your capital to keep itself solvent. Now, this redefinition of a depositor, apparently, according to Ellen Brown, in a piece that she published yesterday, was laid out in a document, a joint paper by the United States Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Bank of England very recently on December the 10th, 2012. And this document establishes that depositors don't actually own their money. When they make a deposit in the bank, it's the bank's money. And the depositors are in the form of creditors. And if the bank needs their money, it can take it and issue them shares in the bank. So imagine if Lehman Brothers had taken this, what would the shares have been worth? Nothing. So in effect,
great.
Yeah.
So, this is in my article tomorrow. I quote from Ellen's article, wonderful article. I mean, she explained it. I mean, putting your money in a savings or a checking account, and it's not your money anymore, Paul. It belongs to the bank. And if the bank wants it, it can take it, and all you get is an IOU, a promise to pay. And if the bank goes bust, sorry, we really wanted to repay you, but we don't have any money to do it.
Yes. In other words, the FDIC deposit insurance is no longer meaningful. It's stripped of its meaning. Now, all of this is very curious because since the Federal Reserve has shown the willingness and ability to print money without limit, to buy up debt assets, both of the banks and of the U.S. Treasury, and it thinks it can do this indefinitely in huge amounts. And we're talking about over $1 trillion a year. And how long has this been going on? I mean, the bank collapse was what, December of 07 or sometime in 08? I mean, it's been going on at least 5 years, right? We're in the sixth year of printing massive amounts of money. Why can't the Fed print the money to repay the depositors instead? If it can print the money to keep the bank solvent, it could, as an alternative policy, let the banks go bust, as they should. You know, capitalism is supposed to work by eliminating unsuccessful enterprises, not keeping them alive with subsidies so that they can waste more resources. So the Fed could let the banks go bust, as they always have in the past, and pay off the depositors with all the money it's printing. But no, it's chosen to pay off the banks, or the bank shareholders, really, is what the issue is, the shareholders of the banks, and to neglect the depositors. And now they're saying not only will they do nothing to help the depositors, they're actually going to take their money, too. So this shows a fundamental change in the whole concept of law and accountability. And we're back to an aristocracy that has one set of rules, and the ordinary people, serfs, who have another set of rules, and the rules of the aristocracy prevail. And they get theirs, and nobody else gets anything except anything that might be left. So this is where we are, and to pretend that we have a democracy is an absurdity. There's no democracy, or that there's freedom in democracy. All this is, it's doublethink. It's newspeak. It's Orwellian to a great extreme. And that's the situation that we're now in. So think about how you're going to protect yourself. Suppose you've been frugal and you've saved. You got a couple $100,000. You've got pension funds somewhere to help supplement the Social Security or to take its place, because they may take that away too. What are you going to do now? Where can you put that? If you say, I got to get it out of the bank, where are you going to put it? What can you? There's no way people can protect themselves. You can say, okay, I'm going to move it offshore. Well, if there's a big breakdown, how do you know you can get it? Or if the financial system here fails, who would, if you need the money, who would the offshore institution wire it to? Or if it comes in, how do you know the bank won't confiscate it, or that it won't directly go into the Treasury, just be diverted and go straight into the U.S. Treasury? If people now have a fundamental problem, they have no way to protect their assets beyond whatever amount they can accumulate in gold and silver in their home and think they can be safe from robbery. That's what you're reduced to. Now, there's no financial security in the Western world.
Well, Homeland Security, namely the FBI, can come into your home and search your home and seize anything they wish. And Homeland Security, this was in Ellen's article, Homeland Security without a warrant could go into any bank and search anyone's safe deposit box and seize, say, gold and silver content that may be stored in a safe place. You're right. There's no place to hide. You can't put it in a safe deposit box and expect it that you'll be safe from losing it. You can't stick it under the mattress because the FBI can come in and turn over your mattress and take whatever is under there or in a closet or any place else. So where do you go? There's no place to go.
Well, that's exactly the point. The financial security, except for the guys running the show, the handful of elites, financial security no longer exists in the West, period. It doesn't exist. Possibly in Switzerland still. It's a small country. How long it can hold out, no one knows. But if you put your stuff in Switzerland, which you could do right now, we don't yet have... See, Cyprus now has capital controls. They can't take their money out of the country. That'll come here. It won't be long, probably. But if you say, okay, I'm getting my money out, and you wired out to Switzerland, if things go wrong and you need it, how do you get it?
Exactly.
How does it get wired back to you? They can't send it to your house. It has to go to a financial institution. But that's what you're trying to escape, the financial institution. So how do you escape it if the only way you can get it back is through a financial institution that you're trying to run away from? And so if there's trouble and there's money is wired in, you see the same thing in Cyprus right now. You can deposit a check into a Cyprus bank, but they will not cash the check for you. So you can put money in the bank. You just can't get it out except for that limited amount they allow. So if you move your stuff offshore and you want to, you say, okay, now, good, I saved my money. It's all crashed. I had it in gold, Swiss francs. I haven't lost any real value. The dollar's now worth a third of what it was worth, but my net worth is the same because I put it in a safe haven. So now I need this money because I haven't got any way to pay my bills or buy food or whatever, and so I'm going to have the money wired back, and you tell in Switzerland to wire some of it back, and what happens? It hits the bank, and it's confiscated. Or the U.S. Treasury has already redirected all wires into banks to its own coffers. There you have it. I mean, what can you do? People don't really realize this. It's too far outside their history, their experience, their expectations. They're not aware. They don't know of these documents that Ellen Brown has brought to our attention, that deals have been worked out that turn depositors into investors, such that their bank deposits are risk capital at risk, and they really haven't any guarantee despite the FDIC insurance deposit. This is a tremendous development. It's a revolution. It's like an overnight coup. And the consequences are that nobody's assets, wealth, property are safe.
It really is true, Paul. I compared it to the looting on Wall Street, but it really is different. Secured bank accounts were thought to be safe. I mean, you get FDIC insurance. The situation in Cyprus, the initial plan, which the parliament voted down before they lost the right to vote again, was that that the small depositors would also be hit with the uninsured ones, a much lower amount. They changed it. They first had, I think, 6.75%. Then they lowered it to 4%. I think it was 9.9% on the uninsured depositors. And now the revised plan, I think it's 20% on them. But I quoted 40% on them. I quoted the
over 100,000 euros, 40%. They were trying to get it from the Russians, but apparently the Russians just took all the money out of the London branches of the Cyprus banks, and actually there was a branch in Russia. So whoever closed the Cyprus banks forgot to close the branches in London and Russia, and so the Russians got their money.
They did that in February. I think there was a big exodus of I think, Russian money in February. They smelled something coming before I ever realized there was anything wrong in Cyprus. So the lucky ones, I guess, got their money out, or at least got some of it out, maybe a good bit of it out. But the ones who didn't, I guess they're stuck for the time being. But I wonder whether innovative, clever lawyers and accountants will find some way around this stuff. These controls, when they put them on, Paul, they claim they're going to be short-term. But the I don't know how often controls are put on, but I suspect this is going to be a very protracted situation.
Well, they can't take them off in Cyprus because all the deposits would flee the banks.
Exactly. So they're going to stay on. I don't know about
and
in
what's
perpetuity.
Going to happen, what may happen, is, but you see, the trouble is that you would expect now people in Spain and Italy would run on the banks. But if you have very much money, what do you do with it? Suppose you've got 200,000 euros. You're going to bring that home and put it in a drawer? I mean, that's, you know, that... That's a lot of cash. How do you keep it safe? How do you, there's no security. The reason it's in the bank is because it was a form of security. When you have that kind of cash in your home, what's the security? So I suspect that people who don't have much money will try to get it out of the banks and buy gold or silver and keep that somewhere. Hide it, bury it in the yard, do something. They'll try to do something like that in order to hold on to something, because the last thing people want is to be unemployed and have no means of sustaining themselves. And that's where it's all headed, which may be the reason for Homeland Security buying 2 billion rounds of ammunition. I don't think that much was fired in World War II. 2,700 tanks. All these detainment camps have apparently been built all over the country. Maybe they're getting ready for the disaster that they're producing. And you can see that follows logically. When you destroy the economy, people's hopes, and then you attack whatever savings they have.
I think it's coming, Paul. I think the seeds have been sowed for a crisis across Europe. I mean, it's already happening across Europe. America will follow these bad policies. I mean, the results that will come from them, it's just a matter of when they'll come and how bad they'll be. But some of the stuff I read and quote, the longer you continue these horrific policies, the worse the crisis may be when it finally erupts full-blown. You just can't keep this stuff stowed away and have no reverberations. It's going to happen. And the powers that be in Washington, I think, suspect this. So they're ready. They buy these mountainous supplies of bullets and the rest of it. Who knows what they have in mind, the detainment camps. And sooner or later, this stuff very much might come.
That's right. It may be sooner than we think. Because as I've written and as my latest book makes clear, we have three massive bubbles. We have a massive bond market bubble, the biggest in history, a massive stock market bubble, the biggest in history, and a massive dollar bubble. And I think the dollar bubble will be the one that pops. And, of course, when it pops, all the other two pop. And there's no solution for that type of a disaster. This will be the biggest financial crisis in human history.
Paul, we're just about out of time. I wanted to make one comment. It may turn out that the 2008 debacle when Lehman went under in the fall, or late summer, I guess it was, of late summer, early fall of 2008, that may just have been a warm-up for what's coming.
Well, it looks like it. You see, the Fed can print money forever to buy bonds until the dollar goes. When the dollar goes, they lose control of the interest rates. You see, if the dollar loses value, it means the value of the bond denominated in dollars loses value. And if the bond price falls, the interest rates automatically rise. That's the way it works. Low interest rates mean high bond prices. Low bond prices mean high interest rates. And so that is how the Fed loses control. It is if the dollar loses its exchange value, and with the BRICS and other countries moving away from the use of the dollar in international trade, the demand for dollars is falling, but the supply isn't. The Fed's creating a trillion new dollars every year.
Well,
supply up, demand down. It means sooner or later the price of dollar has to go down.
I think you've nailed it right on the nose, Paul. We are out of time. I heard something. I'll have to watch this. A rumor has it that Bernanke does not want another term, that he wants to leave. So my feeling is that he knows there's trouble coming, just the way Greenspan knew there was trouble coming, and they simply didn't want to be around when it broke. So they'll leave the mess that they made to somebody else, and they'll slink off into the darkness and say, well, you know, I did my best. It's the other guy's fault. Paul,
right.
Many, many thanks. I look forward to having you back. And I'll just remind listeners, join us, of course, every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Over the weekend, Saturdays and Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.